Alex.
Thank you. So great to see so many people interested in this topic, or maybe it's not so great because it does show there's something going terribly wrong in Europe. So the idea is to talk about the rise of the far right in Europe. And actually one thing that I want to try and do is to explain a little bit about why it would be problematic to speak about the far right in Europe. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the ideological background and its evolution, but also the differences in national traditions of the far right. And this is not just an academic issue, but I think it's an issue that we need to take seriously when we as the left are trying to build coalitions to fight the far right. The ideological differences between the far right in Europe are sometimes substantial and have consequences not only for the left that's trying to mobilize them, but also for how we develop strategies to try and, for example, break up the emerging coalitions between the center-right and the far-right, or the emerging coalitions between different currents of the far-right. So please bear with me as I quote some obscure fascists to try and make this point clear. To start with, maybe I should also say I'm going to talk about the European far right in all of its varieties. But obviously I'm from the Netherlands, which is this terrible little country that few people know of. But it is a country that in the last 20 years, in a weird way, has played a vanguard role in producing a modernized far right that in ideological and historical sense has mostly broken its links with historical classical fascism as we know it from the 1930s. And another argument I'm going to try and make is actually that this kind of modernist far right in the last years, in the most recent period, is in some ways rediscovering its roots of the 1920s and in the 1930s. So even though the Netherlands is this obscure country, I think if we look at the evolution of the far right there, we can draw lessons from it to understand the success of the far right up till now in Europe, as well as its current ideological evolution and also its changing social composition. So by way of introduction, we recently had regional elections in the Netherlands. So these were nationwide elections for the executive of the different regions of the country. And I'm just going to quote some lines from the speech that the leader of the party that became the top party in these elections gave after his election victory. The owl of Minerva spreads his dusk, his wings at dusk. And so we stand here tonight at the 11th hour amidst the debris of what was once the greatest and most beautiful civilization the world has ever known. A civilization that covered every corner of the world. A civilization full of self-confidence, which produced the most beautiful architecture, the most beautiful painting, and the most beautiful music that ever existed under the stars. Our country is part of that family of civilizations. But, like all those other countries in our boreal world, we are being destroyed by the very people who should be protecting us. We are undermined by our universities, our journalists, by the people who receive our art grants and who design our architecture. But among all this disbelief, in this immense vacuum, this cultural and spiritual vacuum, a new imminent religion, a new political theology has erupted. We have been called to the front. We are the bearers, we are the heirs of the greatest civilization that ever existed. We carry a unique power that can never be taken away from us. We have been called to the front. And today, my friend, today the first great battle has been won. Thank you very much. So this is the kind of rhetoric that is used not in a fascist trooper school of, you know, 20 elitist students somewhere. This is the kind of rhetoric that's used by the leader of what is now one of the most prominent parties in my country. It's called the party is called Forum for Democracy. The leader himself is called Thierry Baudet. And I guess as you understand from the way he started his speech by referring to Hegel and the Owl of Minerva, this is a kind of worldview that sees itself self-consciously as elitist. And I think this is important to point out, because at least in Europe, but I think not only in Europe, a name that's often been given to these currents is national, is populism, right? And the idea that these groups supposedly appeal to the common people against the elite. And that's one point I want to make. This has been true of a, what I would say an earlier generation of the far right in Europe, at least until 5 years or even shorter ago. The far right in Europe was dominated by people who in many cases came from the neoliberal right and combined a kind of radical neoliberal economic agenda with nationalism, especially a nationalism against Muslim minorities, and fused this nationalism with Islamophobia. So the, you might have heard of him even here in the US. That is the politics of somebody like Geert Wilders, who developed into, I think, an internationally influential figure of this kind of far right. And to understand the success of this far right, we have to see how it, in many ways, it broke with some of the dogmas of historical fascism and especially historical national socialism. So, for example, on the issue of anti-Semitism, but also on the issue of sexual minorities and LGBTIQ liberation struggles. This was a far right that presented itself as the biggest friends of the Jewish minority and the biggest friends of LGBTIQ groups in society, and did this as a tool, as a weapon against Muslim communities. So this is, has been described as femo-nationalism, and the idea of protecting white women against supposedly inherently misogynist Muslim women, and the idea of homo-nationalism, which was a way of rephrasing the conquests of the LGBTIQ movements in parts of Western Europe as not the conquests of a social movement and of struggle within our societies, but as the products of a supposedly inherently tolerant and hence superior Western civilization. So, to give another quote, the election program of Geert Wilders, this far-right leader in the Netherlands, it literally says, we are going to protect our gays against the Muslims, period. And still today, even the far-right that I just quoted, they take part in the yearly gay pride in Amsterdam. I mean, but all of the time this is framed as we are defending implicitly white LGBTIQ communities against supposedly inherently backward, misogynist, and homophobic Muslim communities. And again, this is not an academic point. There are some polls that at one point the party of Geert Wilders was the most popular party among white gay men in my country. And it, I think this is an example of where the Dutch far right has actually had an international impact. If you look at the evolution of what used to be the Front National in France and its change in references. But like I said at the beginning, I think it's a mistake to lump together all of the currents of the European far right. I would argue that roughly you have three broad ideological families today. You have a family that comes more or less indirectly from classical fascism, which includes most obviously what used to be the Front National in France, now the Rassemblement National, but also a party called Vlaams Belang in Flanders, which is a part of Belgium, and in a different way the FPÖ in Austria. So these are parties that have historical links to fascism. And you see traces of that in their rhetoric, like the FPÖ leader Jörg Haider, who died some years ago. He was famous for his anti-Semitism, which was sometimes quite explicit. Like, he once talked about Ariel Sharon as, "I don't understand how somebody called Ariel can have hands that are so dirty," which is a play on words, because Ariel is also a detergent, a washing liquid. But of course he was very clearly referring to the idea of the corrupt Jew. So that's one family. The other family is this family that I mentioned, of the family of people like Geert Wilders. Geert Wilders is an establishment politician who started out as a speechwriter for Frits Bolkestein. Now, Frits Bolkestein might not say much to people here, but Frits Bolkestein was in the 90s one of the architects of neoliberal economic policies in the EU. So this is an establishment politician who, after 9/11 and the beginning of the war on terror, increasingly radicalized towards the right, and the medium through which this family radicalized was Islamophobia. And this opened the way to a kind of convergence between these two families of the far right, even though they have historically very different reference points. And then finally, you have a more Christian fundamentalist far right, which is sometimes organized in its own parties, especially in Eastern Europe, for example, if you look at Poland, but in other cases has a presence within parties that are originally coming from either this evolved classic far right or the kind of neoliberals turned far right, like Geert Wilders. And in recent years, with ups and downs, there has been a process of ideological convergence between those groups. All of them profited from the ideological climate that was created by the war on terror and Islamophobia, and all of them profited from the, I would say, betrayal by many social democratic parties in the 90s, which alienated large parts of the working class. And I must admit that when I'm here and I see the DSA logo with the rose, I always go a bit like, ee, because that's the logo of the party that in my country abolished Medicare for All and that abolished free higher education. But at the same time, we see this, that a large chunk of the European working class had become politically homeless because of these betrayals. There's also a kind of liberal myth which frames people like Geert Wilders as the new, or Le Pen in France, as the new representatives of the working class. I think this is wrong. If you look more concretely at election results, you see that they indeed have taken over large chunks of, for example, in the Netherlands, the traditional base of social democracy, or in France, of the Communist Party. But another essential element of the coalition that has made them so big as they are is parts of the traditional far right, which has radicalized. And another third element is they have been able to mobilize people who did not vote before, whether these are young people who are able to vote, or people who were not voting before. And they do this with a kind of rhetoric of constant opposition. Like, I always say that in the Netherlands, on a national level, Geert Wilders and now the person I just quoted before, Thierry Bardin, they are the most radical people in parliament in their rhetoric. So they manage to appeal to a sense of discontent and a sense of anger of parts of the working class, parts of the white working class. I'm not saying that all of these people can be won back to the left, but you know, in my country, the city where the far right gets the highest results is the harbor city of Rotterdam, which was traditionally the bastion of militant trade unions and social democracy. So many of these people were on the left before, and I think we can't abandon all of them. To end with, I mentioned before that I think there's a process of ideological convergence between these three families of the far right. I quoted in the beginning this guy, Thierry Bardin. I think he's a symptom of this, but you can see the same thing happening in, for example, in Germany with the rise of the Alternative for Deutschland, the Alternative for Germany, which started out as a right-wing neoliberal party, but which with quite surprising speed has evolved into a fairly classic far-right party. I'll just quote another one of these terrible people. Björn Höcke, who is known as the leader of the right wing of the AfD in Germany, he said in 2016, "The patience of our people is at an end. And already the ancient Romans knew of the Teutonic fury. Dear friends, we will not let ourselves be abolished. We have initiated this change and we will accomplish this change. We need to become ourselves again. When we again become ourselves, we can overcome the neurotic phase that we have been experiencing for 70 years of world history." I think it's significant that he says that Germany has been neurotic for 70 years, which implies that when it was under National Socialism, it was not neurotic. These things are not coincidences. What started out as a rebellion on the right wing of neoliberalism has created an infrastructure of discussion, of magazines, of think tanks, very serious sometimes, of academics and public speakers who are coordinating on a European scale in developing this kind of new nationalist far right, which doesn't have, which sometimes sounds like classical fascism, but on issues like anti-Semitism has a different position. I'm not saying they are not anti-Semitic anymore, many of them are, but it's no longer core to their ideology the way it was for Nazis. And just to end with, I would say this points to one of the errors that much of the European left has made in trying to counter this far right. And I think this is something for debate. In my country especially, but it also applied to Germany, to Belgium, our strategy against the far right was to unmask these people as Nazis, to say and to stick the label of fascist and Nazi and racist on them. And in this way, implicitly we counted on everybody hates Nazis, everybody hates fascists. But this is no longer working, and it hasn't been working for 20 years. And it's no longer a matter of that no longer everybody hates racists. Obviously racism was there all along, but the taboo has been broken. But also in many ways, the far right in Europe has evolved, has reinvented itself. We can't go on by saying these people are simply Nazis and then count on the kind of moral revulsion that this word completely correctly evokes. We need to be seriously studying what they say, and who they mobilize, and which alliances they form. We can no longer ignore the intellectual production that they produce as part of what they call, in explicitly Trumpian terms, a war of position. So I think that's an urgent first step for us, and I look forward to the discussion to develop this. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alex. We're very happy to continue this session on the rise of the far right in the US and Europe. Our next speaker is going to be Kathleen Belew. She has spent 10 years researching and writing this excellent book, which is called Bring the War Home, The White Power Movement and Paramilitary America. And it's gotten wonderful reviews from people like the New York Times, The Guardian, etc. It's available out at Haymarket Books. I would encourage everybody to go and get it. She's an assistant professor of history at the University of Chicago, appeared on Fresh Air Weekend Edition and CBS News. And her work has been featured in a PBS Frontline documentary documenting hate, New American Nazis. So I'd like to ask everybody to give a warm round of applause for Kathleen.
Thank you. People sitting on the floor in the back, can you see me if I go up there? Is that better? No? Doesn't matter? Okay. I'll just sit then. Hi. I'm so sorry about being late. Thank you all for taking the time to come to this session. It's and to come to this conference. It's really heartening to see a full room, you know, in dark times of people who would like to understand the complex moment in which we find ourselves. Okay, so just recently, we marked another anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing. And we did it with still no popular understanding of what that event was and what it meant. So we have to convene a discussion of this history with a sense of urgency. Because churches are burning and worshipers are being killed out of hate and families are being separated and children are being caged. And we recently have heard reports of militias, reportedly including police and veterans on our southern border, involved in the unlawful detention of asylum seekers, not to mention the lawful detention of asylum seekers. All of these are using strategies that come from a deep, decades-long, generations-long history of white power organizing in the United States. And I'll just say, I'm going to use the words organizing and activism about this movement with absolutely no positive connotation attached to them, but just to say that these are people who are trying to deliberately bring about political and radical change through their own action. The violence of this movement has rippled freely from fringe to mainstream. And so we have to begin a discussion about this with the hope that understanding and confronting a history of hate could have some kind of utility in imagining and making way for a different kind of future. Because let me be perfectly clear, without a different kind of response than what we've tried against white power organizing in the past, this action will certainly crush beneath it the lives of more victims and their families and their communities, and will continue to seep further into our structures of governance. So my book, Bring the War Home, is looking at a history of the white power movement from its formation after the Vietnam War to the Oklahoma City bombing. So that takes us from the late 1960s to 1995. What I found in the archive is a broad-based social movement. Men, women, and children. Civilians and active duty troops. People who are rural, yes, but also people in suburbs and people in urban centers. People who are across ages, across gender, across class. Certainly there are a number of felons and high school dropouts, but this movement also had aerospace engineers and millionaires, a few. This is important because what we're talking about is a network of people. They are a network of people who I will explain in a moment. We're using social network activism a la Facebook beginning in 1983-84, so the pre-internet message boards. We're generations into social network activism, the use of social relationships to cement political belief and ideology, and to mobilize people to violence. Okay. There is a big moment that I would like you to think about and take away with you today, which is that in 1983, this movement made a turn towards open warfare on the federal government. Post-1983, I would argue to you that white nationalism is not the correct word to describe what's happening in the United States within this movement. And the reason is that when people say white nationalism, maybe not to specialized listeners like all of you in this room, but to the broader public, I think what people think about when they hear white nationalism is sort of an overexertion of patriotism, or perhaps all Americanism. The image that it calls to mind within the Klan historiography should be the image of the Klansmen marching on the National Mall in Washington, D.C. in the 20s, right? Which is Robin Hood Klansmen with their faces uncovered, but elites in their communities, people who are pro-United States. That's not what this is. Post-1983, the reason I use the word white power is, first of all, that's what these activists most consistently use to describe what they were doing. But also, they're not interested in sort of just injecting whiteness into the United States, although that might be like a nice side effect of the activism. What they want is a total overthrow of the United States. So an incremental approach might involve seizing a white homeland, then taking over the US, then taking over the world to create an all-white globe. That is the end game. That is an inherently more radical thing than white nationalism as it is understood in the mainstream. And it also imagines an Aryan polity as the basis of the nation. They're not interested in the United States. They're interested in a transnational community of white people who can seize space, whether large or eventually small. Okay, so that's why I'm using the phrase white power. We can talk more in the Q&A. There are many arguments to be had all around it. Okay, so 1983 is this turning point. The reason we know about this is partly because there is a annual meeting called the Aryan Nations World Congress, which you've probably run across if you've been reading about this at all at any point over the last several generations. The Aryan Nations World Congress was in Hayden Lake, Idaho, at the headquarters of Aryan Nations, which is a neo-Nazi and Christian identity group mostly. It brought together white power activists across this movement. So Klan, neo-Nazi, skinhead, tax protester, posse comitatus, and more. And the Aryan Nations World Congress is important because it represented not only a meeting of a meeting around tactics and ideology, but also a huge social event, okay? So it's equal parts Christian identity sermon and planning for a race war and like volleyball and like couples getting together and like spaghetti dinner. And it's important to know that these things always come hand in hand in this movement. Always. So when we're talking about white power activism, you have to remember that it is about people and social relationships. Real people, not boogeymen. Real people. Okay. So at the Aryan Nations World Congress in 1983, there may or may not have been a secret meeting at which there was a declaration of war. We have testimony from a number of people who were in the room who said that there was, but we have to remember, of course, that people who testify are doing so under all kinds of coercive influences, including having their children taken away if they don't, being offered witness protection, being offered reduced sentences, etc. So we take the grain of salt, but whether or not there was a secret meeting, we can certainly see that there is a sea change in the way this movement operates after this meeting in 1983, because this is when they begin to use leaderless resistance, better known as just cell-style terror, right? The idea that people can organize within small groups of activists ranging from 1 to, say, 6 to 12 people. The idea is that those cells will act in concert without communication with each other and without direct communication from leadership. Now, that strategy was implemented to sort of respond to the massive surveillance of this movement under COINTELPRO in the 60s, so the earlier generation of Klan surveillance, which I probably don't even need to mention to you, hit the left much harder than it hit the right, but did hit the right. So leaderless resistance was designed actually not around court prosecution, but around foiling the plans of undercover government operatives. It does that very well. It also does ruin the potential of court prosecutions in any kind of larger way pretty well. But there's a bigger effect of leaderless resistance that I think has been its most lasting legacy. And what it is that leaderless resistance allows this movement to disappear as a movement. Leaderless resistance, which is also implemented in 1983, I'm going to say the date a bunch more times so people remember, 1983. Leaderless resistance is where we get this idea of the lone wolf actor. The lone wolf gunman, the lone wolf terrorist, the lone wolf, the single person. That, by the way, comes from this movement. We should all stop using it. These are not lone wolves. When we look at Christchurch, when we look at Pittsburgh, when we look at Charleston, these are not lone wolves. They are connected political actors who are usually in contact with one another, who certainly share an ideology and a repertoire of symbols and actions that we can understand, right? Okay, so after 1983, after this turn to open war against the federal government, there's a whole bunch of action between 1983 and the Oklahoma City bombing in 1995, which represents the largest mass violence carried out by this movement so far. Oklahoma City also represents the most, it's the largest death toll, the largest deliberate mass casualty on the American mainland soil between Pearl Harbor and 9/11. This is a huge event. It is not understood. It's not taught in history books. It's not understood. And I'll just say also, all of this is now up for grabs. This is the first year that my undergraduates don't remember 9/11. They've been at war their whole lives. All of this is up for grabs about what it means and what we're going to do with it. But Oklahoma City, I think, never cohered into narrative and historical understanding. During this period from 1983 to 95, some of what these activists were doing included assassination of enemies, a massive ring of paramilitary training facilities and camps, the theft of tons, and I mean literal tons, of military weapons and material from military posts and bases and armories, the use of those weapons in preparing for race war, the manufacture of their own grenades and landmines. It goes on and on and on like this. They successfully stole millions of dollars, much of which the FBI never recovered, and seems to have been diverted into different pockets of resources that are still used by the movement today. I mentioned just briefly those early computer message boards. Those were called LibertyNet. They started in 83, 84, and they were encrypted for several years before the FBI could even read what was being posted. And then, of course, as the internet proper came online, that strategy provided one, I would argue, one of the early models of this kind of social network activism that we now understand as being like Facebook. This is, of course, much before Facebook. And LibertyNet had, again, not only assassination lists and ideological tracks, but personal ads and recipes and the other kinds of things you would expect in a social network. Okay. I think I just want to quickly say, okay, so I mentioned that what I'm talking about is a group of people that included neo-Nazis, skinheads, Christian Identity, Aryan Nations, Posse Comitatus, etc. I would say to you that both in the scholarship and in the journalistic accounts, I think one of the things that happens when people encounter a alien and really, for many of us, disheartening ideology is that people want to make sense of it and sort it into columns. So there's a lot of energy spent towards who exactly is a Klansman, who exactly is a skinhead, who exactly is a neo-Nazi, what exactly do each tattoo, which tattoo goes to which group is in which spot, right? The way it works in the United States in this period, and my sense is still in the present moment, is that actually this is a very flexible kind of system of beliefs. We see people going from one group to another. People commonly will have tattoos of multiple belief systems, they'll move between them, and they describe for themselves that these divisions are much less important to them than we have made them on the left. So for instance, they'll say like, it's like a skinhead is Baptist and a Klansman is a Church of Christ, like we're all Christian. Or they often describe it as like one guy's in the Navy, one guy's in the Army, but we're all in the military. So there is a circulation and all of it is working as a coherent white power movement. Okay, in the 1980s, what we're talking about can be understood if you think about sort of concentric circles like a bullseye. In the middle, there's about 25,000 what one scholar has called hardcore members, and this points again to masculinity as the main mode of understanding what this is, but that's women too. Those hardcore members live and breathe within the movement. They marry one another, they go to church in the movement, they get their counseling in the movement, they pick each other up from the airport, they train together in paramilitary camps, all of it together in the movement. Outside of that, we have another 150 to 175,000 people. Those are people who do public-facing stuff, like go to rallies, subscribe to the newspaper, go to marches. Outside of that is another 450,000 people who don't themselves subscribe to the literature, but who regularly read it. And then we can imagine that this goes on, and that we have a more diffuse circle outside of that of people who would never read something that says official newspaper of the Knights of the KKK, but who would agree with the ideas that are presented in it. This concentric circle model both pushes ideas out from that hardcore center to what we would say is the mainstream conservative belief system, and it also pulls people in when they can be radicalized and kind of turned to this mode of organizing. Now, just by way of comparison, the John Birch Society, which is still thought of as kind of the example of fringe right-wing activity in the United States in the same time period, reached around 100,000 people in 1965 when it peaked. So smaller and also much less violent. But John Birch has been studied exhaustively, has been commented on exhaustively. So one of the things I'm trying to figure out in this book is why so little public and scholarly attention when Birch is still discussed so much. One of the reasons has to do with this change to leaderless resistance and the way that the movement has been able to disappear itself from public view. Everything I talk about in Bring the War Home, the main events of these chapters, were talked about at the time. Things like Klan paramilitary training camps, footage appeared on like Good Morning America and the Today Show. There was a deeply unfunny, but there it was, Saturday Night Live sketch about the Greensboro shooting, which we can talk more about. I would imagine this is familiar to people here, but it's the 1979 shooting of leftist demonstrators in Greensboro, North Carolina, by Klan and Nazi gunmen. Much more to say about that. So this was all known. It's the mechanism of forgetting that we have to really think about with the Oklahoma City bombing. Okay, point number two has to do with failed trials. I'm gonna go quickly and we can come back and Q&A to more. There was a large-scale seditious conspiracy trial of white power activists ranging from kind of rank and file up to leadership in 1987-88 in Fort Smith, Arkansas. This involved the fruits of a whole bunch of smaller investigations, so there were a lot of participating witnesses, including people from within the movement, and they talked vividly about race war. They talked about 30 gallons of cyanide seized before it could be delivered to the water supply of a major city, which would be around 400,000 fatalities. They talked about assassinations, a reign of paramilitary training. They pushed two huge laundry hampers of military-grade weapons through the courtroom. And they also showed the writings and communication of this movement, which declared seditious conspiracy. They said that's what they were doing, was trying to overthrow the government. It was wholly evident, declared in the writings and speeches of the movement, and outfitted with semi and fully automatic rifles, machine guns, rocket launchers, anti-tank weapons, and grenades. But the trial failed. All of these activists walked free. A historical reading of this trial, we'll just say, casts doubts on its efficacy. Several things happened, including two defendants had romantic relationships with jurors. People gave lengthy character testimony about their service in Vietnam and argued that no one that serves their country in wartime could ever become a seditious conspirator against it. We'll just, in short, like the historical record does not bear that out as factual. They also had to exclude a lot of evidence that was seized in Mexico because of chain of custody problems that would have pointed to a more direct chain of evidence to leadership in the movement. It goes on like this. Okay, so we have this embarrassing acquittal in Fort Smith, after which there is an FBI policy not to pursue white power violence as part of a movement, and that they're going to pursue only individual actors. There's a memo. That memo is in place for the Oklahoma City investigation. And if anything, this attitude only deepens with Ruby Ridge and Waco in the early 1990s, which are both tragic events, but also tremendously embarrassing for the FBI and ATF. So the policy at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing is that they will pursue only individual actors. They will not try to tie these things to a broader movement. Sorry, the language is, quote, no attempts to tie individual crimes to a broader movement, end quote. So there's no investigation that attempts to do this. There's no prosecutorial strategy that attempts to do this. And I will just say, My look at McVeigh's involvement in this movement represents a full chapter of the book. I can't give it to you all right now, but I'll just give you the short version. A few highlights include his choice of a building that had been a movement target since the early 1980s, the use and distribution of the movement novel, The Turner Diaries, in formulating the plan for the bombing, his presence as high-level security for the Michigan militia. That's not an ordinary membership thing, that's an elite actor thing. His possible membership in a Klan chapter. He also had contacts and attempted contacts with white power groups, including the Arizona Patriots, the National Alliance, and a separatist compound at Elohim City. The date of the bombing was not only the date of the Waco siege, but also the planned execution date of a prominent white power activist who had once targeted the federal building in Oklahoma City and who lay on his bed laughing before his execution at the footage of the bombing. Additional evidence abounds, and not at all at the level of conspiracy theory, but just a simple social geography of McVeigh, his life, where he was, what he said he believed, places him decisively in this movement and as an actor of leaderless resistance. So all of this is to say that white power activity in the United States in the present moment is not new. There's a long history that can be useful in understanding what's happening and how we might confront it. But I would just say it is this process of forgetting and astonishment, this durable sort of cycle of forgetting that we knew about this and then reemergence, that I think really directs our attention to the parameters of public debate and public memory, and also to what might be different in our current moment that might open the way to confronting racist formations in our society today. Thank you.